don't start trouble. Nobody's going to announce tomorrow. The results are not correct. If that happens, people will be provoking.
You're dealing with Jacob Zuma. Every stage is a theater for him.
Floyd will be a minister of finance if they agree. These people, because
the EFF and the ANC could still come together, possibly not if they make sure Floyd Chivambu, the Minister of Finance, as we have heard that demand.
If you come to us with a demand that Ramaphosa must step down as a president, that is not going to happen.
The broader question is whether our foreign policy has completely lost its way.
The people of Palestine, they're denied the right to enjoy the freedoms we so love.
That is a no-go area.
Helen, welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. We really appreciate you joining us in between your very busy schedule, I suspect. Let's just go to the heart of the of our conversation today. You know, obviously everyone is sitting, waiting and watching to see where this enema is going to go, whether it will deliver the goods or not. This GNU enema.
The GNU.
Yes, the GNU.
Another GNU.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, did you imagine during the campaign for the election that the outcome would be a government of national unity?
Well, the DA does polling, and we are very good at polling, and we do polling scientifically and have done so for a very long time. So we come extremely close, within one percentage point of the outcome of the election. And we saw for a long time the ANC tracking well below 50%. And then about a month out from the election, the ANC started going up again towards 50%. And we thought they might just get over 50%. And then with about a week, 10 days to go, they fell right back down to 40%. And we went into the election with the ANC at 40. Mm-hmm. So we knew that there was going to be a coalition governing South Africa, yes. Mm-hmm. Before we went into the election, we knew that it would be a coalition government. Mm-hmm.
But did you have an idea of who else might, you know, would have had to be part of the... Maybe with the ANC, you had a clearer idea, but the bits and pieces, the other bits and pieces of the GNU.
Well, we knew that the ANC would be able to go into a straight coalition with very few parties. If the ANC got 40%, they would not be able to go into a coalition with just a few small parties to get over 50%. Mm-hmm. They would need one of the big parties. We didn't know how well the EFF or MK would do, although MK was showing up very strongly in our polling as the biggest party in KwaZulu-Natal well before the election. So we knew that MK was going to do well. The EFF, we thought, would get about 10.5%, or between 8 and 10%. That's where they'd been polling. Then ended up getting just over 9, if I recall correctly. So we knew everyone was in the ballpark, and we thought there would be three parties that could take ANC over 50. One was us. One was the EFF, one was MK.
Mm-hmm. Elsewhere, you described MK as a catalytic intervener. I think that was your... Did you see that coming, or were you as surprised as much of the country in terms
well,
of
we weren't, performance? Well, we weren't surprised by that because we saw it coming in the polls. Mm-hmm. The polls told us early on that MK would be a complete game changer, and they were. They took 45% of the vote in KwaZulu-Natal, which was higher than our polling had them, I must say. But then we always find polling in northern KwaZulu-Natal very, very difficult to gauge, to get to many rural voters who don't have cell phones, who don't have access to network and things like that. So it's hard. But MK did better than any of us thought they would. And they were a catalytic game changer. It was them that drove the ANC below 40%. And that opened the door for the realignment of politics, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would have been the imperative, would you have said, to go the route of the GNU?
Well, you had to have a coalition government because no party got above 50%, right? And the ANC could have done a straight coalition with us. They could have done a straight coalition with MK, And I think they might have been able to do a coalition with the EFF to get over 50%. I haven't added that up. It would have been very close. And they might have needed one more small party with the EFF to get over the line. So those are the coalitions that the ANC could have done. And the question was, which one would they choose? Now, they didn't want to choose any of them. That's why they decided to call it a government of national unity. They started off having talks with everybody and allowed parties to exclude themselves. The first party that excluded itself was MK, then the EFF, and we were kind of the last man standing.
Mm. And as federal chair, you would have been central to all the calculations and the considerations of which way to go, who to talk to, etc. Now, could you take us behind the scenes? You know, now before the election, you're competing directly with the ANC.
Yes.
At what point? Where is the turning point where you're saying, "Okay, guys, we've seen the numbers post the election. Let's go for a conversation with the ANC."
The turning point came when we realized what we had to do to prevent a coalition of MK, EFF, and ANC. That would have been a total disaster for the economy. The rand would have crashed through the floor. There would have been a mass exodus of any form of investment in South Africa, and unemployment would have gone from 40% to 60%. So we knew we had to stop that. And then the question was, how do we stop that? Now, we knew that we had the numbers to stop that. And we knew that we had a lot of leverage. Now, we had to decide for ourselves, how will we use that leverage? There were lots of people in our party who were not happy at all with the notion of going into a coalition with the ANC, because, as you rightly say, we'd fought them for many, many, many years. And there were some that wanted us to stay in opposition. And there were others that wanted us to do a confidence and supply model, which would be us taking the legislature, the speaker, and all the portfolio committee chairs and all the oversight positions. And we would have gone for some other oversight positions, such as, let's say, the public protector, the Human Rights Commission, etc., and perhaps more seats on the Judicial Service Commission as a check and balance to the abuse there. And then let the ANC take the executive. So that was definitely a model which we discussed at some length. And it was a very complex conversation that we had. In the end, we decided on what we call the hybrid model, which would be to take a limited number of seats in the executive and to have seats in the oversight and in the portfolio committees and in parliament, and then very much play the role of keeping and building a centrist government, as well as, crucially, affecting the way South Africa is governed, showing the DA difference at national level, crucially, and equally ensuring that we could impact our portfolios and make sure that South Africa was governed better. So that is what we set out to do. That wasn't a unanimous support of the party, but enough people in the party supported it. And we are a democratic organization, so we go with what the majority decides in the right forums. And then that's what we went for.
Mm-hmm. And the negotiators were yourself?
Yes, I was elected as the chair of the negotiating team. And then there was Siviwe Gwagube, who was our chief whip before in the National Assembly. There was Ivan Meyer, who's our national chairperson. There was Alan Windy. There was Ryan Kutsi and Tony Leon. Mm-hmm. So they were there. Tony and Ryan, well, Tony's obviously still a member of the DA, and I think Ryan is too, but they were not active in party politics at the moment, but they were brought in for their expertise, for their skills. Ryan has been advising governments all over the world for quite a long time. Tony has very deep experience of politics in South Africa, obviously, so they were brought in.
Mm, mm. And on the other side, you were dealing with, there would have been Figile Mbalula.
Well, it wasn't always the same people. Yeah. The person who remained constant throughout was Phoebe Potgieter. Mm-hmm. She is the chief executive or chief operating officer of the ANC. Then David Makura was there a lot of the time. Parks Tau was there a lot of the time. Enoch Godongwana was there quite a bit of the time. The two little Ramakgopa ministers, Gwen and Maropene, were there for one meeting. Fikile Mbalula was there on several occasions. I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. I probably am. Parks Tau, I mentioned, didn't I? Yes, I mean, those people were there, and they weren't all there all of the time.
Okay. Roughly how many meetings would this have taken? I'm just trying to figure out, you know, for those of us who were completely blind to what was going on behind the scenes.
Look, it depends when you start. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 meetings, I think, over those 10 days, and then 1,000 phone calls and WhatsApps and other things, yes.
And in terms of your support base, I take it that the process of explaining stroke selling the agreement continues. But how has the GNU gone down with your support base?
Very well. We did polling throughout the whole period, of course, because we poll every day in the DA. And DA supporters were very, very much in favor of us going in because they knew the alternative was the EFF and MK going in, and that would be the end, literally. It's an existential question for South Africa. It's an absolutely existential question around whether we have an economy, whether we create more jobs. I mean, you know, it is do or die when you get to those moments. And mostly DA voters understand that.
Mm-hmm. And they
were fine. There were an overwhelming number of DA voters supported it.
Now, you are a very powerful presence in the leadership of the DA. You know, one might say even in the politics of South Africa. Some people might say you've got experience in different levels of government. Why did you stay out of the GNU?
Because I'm not a member of parliament. So if I'd been a member of parliament, I probably would be in there somewhere. But I decided not to stand for parliament. My job now is the Secretary General of the DA. So I run the DA. I'm trying to get the DA into a strong fighting force.
So the you know, in other contexts, you know, people talk about multiple centers of power. You know, I mean, as federal chair, you're very influential, but you've got the party leader as well.
Yes.
Yeah,
but I mean,
how do you navigate that?
Well, we've always had that.
In the government and you outside.
Well, we've always had that. We've always had, you know, I am the Fikile Mbalula of the DA. And maybe he's the Helen Ziller of the ANC. I don't know. Anyway, I run the party and the DA believes in the separation of party and state. The DA believes in the separation of party and state. So I run the party. I run the party in terms of the party's constitution, its rules, its codes of conduct, et cetera, et cetera. John is the leader of the party. He sets the vision. He takes a key role in the policy process. He takes now a key role as a minister. And obviously, he leads our party in parliament. So it's a very different role. And my role is to build the party.
Sometimes, especially in the earlier days of the GNU, it sounded like the entire arrangement was under strain, you know, with all the public spats and, you know, between you, Figile, you know. How stable would you say it is at this point?
It's stable at this point, very stable. I think the reason it's stable is that people realize what the alternative is. You know, it's very seldom that you can say there is no alternative. And we know that if we want to save South Africa at the moment, there is no alternative. And I've been talking about the realignment of politics for the longest time, since I became the leader of the DA. And people thought that I meant getting all the smaller parties together. That's a small part of it. But I've always argued that the realignment of politics has to happen down the middle of the ANC. It has to go apart because there is such an ideological divergence between its various key players that they can't really form a coherent party anymore. And that as the ANC comes apart, there will be a major realignment of politics.
Mm. Now, can we talk about some of the characters that your fellow actors on the post-election stage?
Yeah.
Fikile Mbalula, what's your relationship like with him?
I've got a good professional relationship with Fikile. I WhatsApp him, he WhatsApps me. I mean, we're both secretary generals of our party, so it would be stupid if we didn't speak to each other. We are often in a conflictual relationship, obviously, by virtue of the fact that we belong to different parties. But we have a professional, direct relationship. And he knows with me, what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm. Last week, the other week recently, Gwendolyn Dasha said that you are the biggest threat to with your behavior to the GNU because you wanting to paraphrase him to tell you want the DA
ministers to report
to you, not to the president.
I don't know where he got that from.
Do you talk to him?
I think Wendy sucks things out of his thumb. I really do. I don't know where he came up with that. The journalist said to him, your journalist, where did you get that from? He said, oh, from her social media posts. Gareth and Onslin and other people looked throughout my whole social media post. There's nothing that says that. Absolutely nothing that says that. So he invented it. He sucked it out of his thumb. And even your journalist went to my social media post and couldn't find it. Then your journalist wrote and said, no, it was because you said something about relative autonomy of the ministries. So I said, yes, I was discussing the German system. Someone asked me to do an interview on coalitions in general. And I was saying the German system is a good one because it's geared towards coalitions. The South African system is not conducive to stable coalitions. For many reasons, but one of the reasons is that it's geared towards a majoritarian system, which proportional representation systems rarely are. Proportional representation systems drive towards coalitions. And when you have a coalition system like they do in Germany and like we have here, then you have a very careful division of labor between the chancellor, the cabinet, and individual ministers. And that is spelt out, and individual ministers have what they call relative autonomy. And I explained that. And he must have just heard one word from one person working in his office and added one and one together and make 11. Truly.
Let's talk about the other character, the central character, the president. This deal between the DA and the ANC, was it driven by him? Was it predicated on him being the its champion? Where does he fit? What is his role in the? Was he the leader? Was he the facilitator?
Well, the president was never in the negotiations, but I have no doubt that the negotiation team reported to the president every day. Andrew Snell, who works in the presidency, was on different occasions in the negotiations. So I should have mentioned his name as well. Andrew Snell was there on occasion, and he became to play a very, very prominent part in the end. And I realized that he was the one reporting to the presidency what was going on. So I think he works in the presidency or worked in the presidency, and I think he knew exactly what was going on. So I think the president got feedback every time we met, but I don't think he was centrally involved. He just said, keep going.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the deal can survive him? In the ANC, things happen. People get recalled.
I know things down, happen. People, things also happen in the DA, believe me. Listen, that's a very, very big question. And that's even more of a challenge to us to make it work. Because if President Ramaphosa goes, it obviously depends on who succeeds him. And if Paul Mashatile succeeds him, because in the ANC, the precedent is very firm that the deputy president of the ANC succeeds to the presidency. If they follow that precedent, then from everything I know and have read about Paul Mashatile, the going won't be smooth for us. Now, obviously, I haven't got that directly from Paul Mashatile, but I think a lot does depend on President Ramaphosa staying where he is.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the DA itself. Mm. What is its future beyond, you know, looking forward, you know, post the formation of the GNU? In other words, does it want to become a majority party one day, or is it happy to remain a one of many or several minority parties, if you like?
Mike, I just hope that I explain this so that everyone can understand this forever. In proportional representation systems, it encourages a multiplicity of parties. It is not a constituency-based system where you have a two-party system like in Britain, for example. It is a proportional representation system which encourages many people to stand and form political parties. Our problem is that we don't have a threshold, so that means that a party that gets 0.2% of the vote can put the mayor of Johannesburg in because they have the balance of power on that one seat. So it is critically important to understand that a proportional representation system, a majority that is over 50%, is very, very rare. We had it in South Africa since 1994 because we're not a usual democracy. The ANC had the massive liberation dividend, and as a consequence, the ANC has been an over 50% party till this election. But you must understand how unusual that is in a proportional representation system. And the ANC will never get above 50% again.
Again.
No. Mm. And they must get used to it. And our aim nationally is not to get above 50% because it's unrealistic. Our aim is to be a big party in the field. And we would like to be the biggest party in the field in many of the metros after 2026. So when you are in a political party, you're always looking at the next election. That's what you're looking at. And I'm sitting there and thinking about nothing else but 2026. That is the next local government election. We had a big federal council meeting where we talked about the 2026 election yesterday. We are all systems go for the 2026 election. And our goal there is to explain to voters, especially in Gauteng, the aim is not to get above 50% because no party can. The aim is to be the biggest party because then you get to put together the coalitions. Then you get to define much of the playing field. And so in coalition systems, it's wrong to talk about becoming a majority party. You become the biggest party in the coalition. We also have an anomaly in the Western Cape. We started in Cape Town with a seven-party coalition. We really worked hard to show people the DA difference. Enough people saw the DA difference to vote us in with a clear majority in the Western Cape in 2009. And we've kept that clear majority ever since. But that's also extremely unusual in a coalition system. So we must actually understand that that is an anomaly from the norm in a coalition system. Our job is to become the biggest party in all the metros. Okay. We're already the biggest party in Nelson Mandela Bay. And we were only 6 percentage points behind the ANC here in Gauteng. 6 percentage points only.
For me, the intriguing thing is this, that you're already talking about the municipal elections which are coming down the line.
That's all I'm talking about now.
Yeah. So I was saying that the how comfortable or challenging is it going to be, I don't know if you're still, you know, under the present circumstances nationally, you'd still describe yourself as opposition or you describe yourself differently because you are outside and you want to hold governments to, you know, accountable, but you are also inside.
Okay.
How easy or difficult is that going to be? Because some of your members are actually ministers.
Yeah.
In the cabinet.
Mike, the role of parliament, as Judge Zondo said so plainly, is to hold the executive to account. And our parliamentarians in parliament will be just as tough as holding DA ministers to account as they will be holding ANC ministers to account. We know what the role of parliament is. We think Parliament should be much stronger. We think that Parliament should really and very strongly hold the executive to account. And we will play that role vigorously, irrespective of whether we've got DA ministers in government. Mm-hmm. We're now a party of local government. We run local governments in 7 out of the 9 provinces, which is huge. We run an entire province without a coalition. And now we're in national government. So we are a party of government. We're in opposition in some places, obviously, but we're a party of government at 3 spheres of government.
Okay. Now, just to go to the GNU agreement itself, you know, it talks about building a capable, merit-based developmental public service. Mm. How do you propose to transform the public service? You know, because as you know, it is the cold face, basically, of delivery, but it's got a history.
Well,
in terms of performance, in terms of political orientation, etc.
I interpret transformation as a drive towards better quality. When I talk about transformation in that context, I'm not talking about race. Mm. I'm talking about outstanding people in every position. And I'm talking about merit-based appointments, because if you don't get a merit-based appointment in the state, everybody who has to be serviced by that person outside the state suffers. Mm. Only one person benefits, and that's the guy who didn't deserve the position. Everybody else who depended on the service that they have to provide suffers. And the people who suffer most are the poor, because wealthy people can buy themselves security, education, health, whatever. Poor people depend on the quality of the people in the state to deliver all of those things. So race-based appointments don't help poor people at all. Merit-based appointments, which does not mean white. Mm-hmm. Merit-based appointments of all races is what we're talking about. That benefits the poor. Mm-hmm. And the developmental state was pioneered, the concept in Japan. And they pioneered that after the Second World War, in which they said that their most important job was only to hire the best people into the state to make sure that all their policies facilitated economic growth and jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to be doing. Biggest problem by far in South Africa is the 42% unemployment rate on the expanded definition. That is catastrophic. Mm. And every single barrier to growth, every single barrier, including BEE, which is a big barrier to growth, needs to be gotten out of the way so that what we can have is take the brake off growth. The government must take its foot off the pedal. It doesn't have to do anything else. And the economy will grow.
Mm. But I hear what you're saying. The where I was wanting to go to was that the civil service has got a history.
Yeah.
You have just mentioned about the wrong appointments, people unsuitable people being given particular responsibilities. Mm-hmm. The performance generally, for example, of many of the municipalities, if you go to the bar, the service system has not worked for years. You know, and then it doesn't look like it's possible anyone's capable of fixing it. So because when you're dealing with the civil service, you're dealing with people in there who've got a particular culture, who've grown to do, you know, to a way of doing things, you know, in a particular way. How are you going to transform that in terms of how people think, how people approach their work, etc.?
We can't do that across government. We'll try, but we can do that in the ministries we have. And let me give you an example. Leon Schreiber is the Minister of Home Affairs now. Mm-hmm. And Leon Schreiber went in there with a massive backlog of visas, passports, everything, IDs, everything. And he just put together a team and he said, your job is to get rid of the backlog. And many people came to the DA's head office and said, you've got a Minister of Home Affairs. This is my problem. This is my problem. This is my problem. We sent them all through to the spot that Leon Schreiber told us to send them through to. And literally within days and a week, many of them were resolved. And within 4 weeks of taking office, he'd reduced the backlog by 30% because he had a plan. He put together a team. He put the right people in the team and they just worked day and night to clear the backlog, which he gave them as a mandate. So in our departments, we will be able to do that. And hopefully you will see the results. In education, it's going to be much, much, much more difficult because the national minister doesn't run education. The provinces do. The provinces have power over education. Mm. The national minister does major systems, frameworks, norms and standards. And it's very, very difficult for the minister to do all of these things and to get right what's happening at the individual schools. So that's the hardest one to get right. And the rest, we can see real differences very quickly.
Mm-hmm. But we know also that the civil service is in many parts highly unionized. Will you be working with the unions to
Education, they've got
the culture, you know, the way people work?
You know, in education, you've got to deal with SATU. If every teacher would just come to school on time, present, punctual, and fully prepared for every day's work, and if they could ensure that every child is present, punctual, and prepared, and if every child could get 7 hours teaching and learning a day for 210 days every year, we would transform education without spending another cent. You do not know how much the culture of time wastage destroys education. You know, many of us like me, I was raised with a very, very strict focus on time management. And you don't know how much you can get done if you manage your time properly. You can get a huge amount of time done, amount of stuff done. And most children can learn most things if they spend enough time with teaching and learning, if they get good textbooks, and if they have the right technology, and if they are tested at regular intervals. Those four T's, I always say. Time, good teachers, good texts, good technology, and testing. The five T's, you'll sort out education. Mm-hmm. But that means that everyone has to be present, punctual, and prepared, and managing their time, time, every day.
Will you be engaging the unions on all of those? Because this sounds like a major culture change.
It is a major culture change. But you know what? I mean, I always get into trouble from what I say, but what I say is true. So in 20 years, they'll look back and saying, oh, she got into big trouble for that, but that was an obvious truth. So I don't mind telling the truth. I don't mind being the canary in the coal mine. If we want this democracy to succeed, we better have some culture changes. Time management is only one. Another big one is maintenance. We must fix things when we see they're starting to break. We mustn't let them get destroyed before we try and fix them. The culture of maintenance is a crucial culture to develop in a society. The culture of sticking by your word. If you say something, people must know your word is your bond. And most important of all, the culture of looking after your children if you're a father and not walking away from them. Mm-hmm. If we don't get that culture change, we're nowhere, you know.
Okay.
Teachers can't make up for absent fathers.
Mm. And mothers.
Well, mothers usually, I mean, the South African family is a mother, a single mother raising kids often. And it shouldn't be like that. Fathers should not be allowed to walk away from their kids. That's a culture that has to change.
Yeah.
But I know from saying that now there's going to be a huge outcry and I'll be on the front page of the Sunday Times being called all kinds of names. But it is true.
The GNU agreement also talks about non-racialism. It mentions non-racialism. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think we continue to have problems around race and racism in South Africa? It's 30 years since 1990.
Well, you know, I mean, it's 200 years in the United States and they're more divided on race than they've ever been before. And it's because, there are many reasons. There's genuine racism still. There is. I'm not going to ever deny that. And where I see it, I hate it. But this whole notion of critical race theory, which says every single institution, every single interaction in society is infused with white, male, heterosexual domination. And everybody's role is to disaggregate that, dismantle that, destroy that. And all the institutions have been built to defend the white patriarchy. That's the theory behind it. And it comes in very crude form over Twitter and Facebook from America and all of that kind of nonsense. And then everybody thinks, oh, the reason why I'm not in this position must be because of racism, or the reason that I haven't succeeded in this must be because of racism. And that doesn't mean to say racism does not exist, but it is very dangerous to turn that into a reason or an excuse for everything. And it is very dangerous to this notion of development for people to lose all sense of I'm responsible for my own fate and I'm responsible for my own future. And this culture of being able to blame others, especially on a racial basis, and especially when it's got credence in history, it's got actual credence in history, is going to be a terrible break on our society. And there's a comfort for many people in defining every situation as a situation in which they were the victim. And in this whole philosophy that I've spoken about, victimhood is very prized. If you've got victim, you've got, if you're a victim, you've got virtue and you're a good person and there's an evil villain who's put you in that place, that binary. So it's very convenient for many people to keep racism alive. That doesn't mean to say it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But there's a huge industry out there that needs racism to exist. And then where it doesn't exist, needs to invent it. Mm-hmm. So they will sit and analyze this discussion with you, between you and me, and they will disaggregate it, and they will deconstruct it, and they will show you how racist I am towards you.
Mm-hmm. But in instances where there is racism, do you believe that we act firmly enough against people? In other words, our level of tolerance as a country of racism.
You know what, Mike? There's a huge amount of racism directed at white people in this country as well. So it is not a one-way street. If you go on social media and see what black people say to white people and about white people, if any white person dared to say that about a black person, there would be an outcry for weeks, and rightly so. Talking about killing whites, getting, I mean, it's normal on social media. And whites are a minority in South Africa. Remember that. When they talk about minorities in the United States, we're the minority here. And all of that needs to come to a dead end, but it's not a one-way street. There's enormous racism addressed against whites.
But should we be acting against it?
Yes, absolutely. But we shouldn't be inventing it. We shouldn't be inventing it. You know, this whole thing about subliminal racism, or there is such a thing as a microaggression, but it's not something to expel a student from school about. Deal with it. Mm. Talk it through. Mm. And don't see racism where it doesn't exist and invent it. Mm. You know, lots of things can be explained in totally different ways other than racism. Mm-hmm. Where it is, deal with it properly. And it's not a question of two legs good, two legs bad, and four legs good. One side is not always right. Remember Schweizer-Rennicker? Ilana Barkhuizen in that classroom was not practicing apartheid by separating the black children from the white children. The black children couldn't speak Afrikaans, and she had them with their language interpreters so they could all hear and understand what was happening in an Afrikaans class, which was a fair way of handling the children. But if you just look at the visuals, you think, aha, that's racist. Meanwhile, that's a teacher ensuring that, I think it was a Tswana-speaking teacher, can translate into Tswana for the children. So what you see is often not the case, and jumping to conclusions and turning things into a big race incident without getting to the facts is wrong.
Let's turn to Cape Town. You once were the mayor.
Yeah,
you ran the city.
I was.
One of the conversations around Cape Town is that it is a city that's got two, perhaps pretty much like the rest of the country. You know, you've got
not the rest of the country
that works very well, and then you've got the other parts that, you know, that's got serious problems. What's your reading of what's happening in Cape Town? You know, for example, someone living in the suburbs versus someone living in Khayelitsha, for example, where I gather there are extortion gangs, all kinds of things.
Well, that's not because of whites.
No. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we're talking about Cape Town as a city, because one of the things that the DA prides itself in is that Cape Town is the best run city.
It is the best run city, but it's not the DA. You know, every single government metric says that.
Yeah.
Every single government. I mean,
but is that how all Cape Townians experience Cape Town, irrespective of where they live?
Look, you've got to start with the question: what can people expect from local government? Now, we're talking local government here. You're talking about Cape Town. The question is, do you get clean running water delivered through a tap to your place of residence? Yes or no? When the electricity is being generated by Eskom, do you get electricity into your house? Yes or no? Is your rubbish collected regularly at the scheduled time? Yes or no? Are your potholes filled when they are reported on the system? Yes or no? Have you got a public transport system that is affordable and that can get you to town? Yes or no? Do the traffic light gets fixed when they're broken? Are the street lights fixed? Yes or no? Even when they get thrown out by stones all the time? Does the ambulance come when you call them, even though the ambulance is attacked by gangs when they go in and everything's stolen? Do you have those services? Does your toilet flush when you flush it? And the sewage doesn't run into the local river? If you have those services, the local government is working for you. Mm-hmm. That is the job of local government.
But if I'm a citizen of Cape Town, mm-hmm. and I live on the Cape Flats, mm-hmm. or I live in Khayelitsha, mm-hmm. and I've got all the problems. I mean, if like now, you know, in the rainy season, mm-hmm. You can see the challenges of people who live in the shacks, for example.
Well, you see,
or the people who live on the Cape Flats who live among gang, you know, got gangsters among them,
now,
lords and all of that.
The flooding with the shacks is a tragedy, but the vast majority of people have all the services that I'm speaking about. The vast majority of people, despite the fact that we've had to keep up with a massive influx of people into the Western Cape. So there's a huge number of people who come into Cape Town. And if it was such a terrible place, they wouldn't come there. Why are they coming there? They come there because...
Even the ones who live in the Shetlands.
Why do they come to Cape Town?
Hmm.
People aren't stupid.
So you're saying they come to Cape Town because?
Because there's a better chance of getting a job. A much better chance of getting a job. There's a better chance of getting your children into a decent school. There's a better chance of getting into a clinic that works. There's a better chance of getting basic services that work. And people live on land that is unserviced. They come and they invade a piece of land. There's no services. There's no stormwater drainage. There's nothing. And they build on that. And then when the rain comes, it's often a low-lying piece of land. Often a piece of land where the sand miners have been, and they've dug it very low, almost to the water table. And when the rains come, those people get flooded out. It's terrible. It's terrible. But then we take people into community halls that work and are still functional and that are there. And we feed people and we get them out of the water.
Mm.
But when people live on unserviced land, and we never put people on unserviced land, that is land that people erect their own shacks on. You're not ever going to get in a flood a stormwater drain that works. In many of the shack settlements that do have services, where we've put services in and often retrofitted services, people build over the infrastructure. So they will build over the stormwater drainage system. They will build over the fire hydrant. And I mean, they build over the railway tracks. That's why they had to close the rail to Khayelitsha, because people build on the railway tracks. And the reason why you can build on a railway track if you put those planks across is that it lifts you and you don't get a risk of flooding.
Mm.
So when the services don't work, it's often because people have built on those services.
Mm. Mm. So Helen, with your experience of Cape Town, do you see the problems on the Cape Flats, or in Khayelitsha and all the other places being resolved? Can they ever be resolved? Because obviously it's unsustainable, you know, that one part of the city is progressive, is developed, and it's safe for, and then other parts of the city are the opposite.
But we're progressively developing the whole city. I live right next door to Langa Township. I live in Pinelands, which literally everybody calls Upper Langa. That's where I stay. And Langa has got all the services that I've spoken to you about. They've got community centers, they've got sports fields, they've got day hospitals, they've got clinics, they've got a number of schools, they've got it. What they need is social cohesion. We need to have parental role models that stops children getting onto drugs and alcohol young. We need people who are prepared to give evidence in court against drug dealers and other people. And we need the community to work with us to crack the gangs and drug problem. That is huge. And when the gangs and the drug gangs get hold of your community, it is terrible because they assassinate each other and the community becomes terrified of them and the community actually ends up protecting them. It is a terrible, terrible situation to get into. I've read all about it in places like Mexico, in places like Brazil. And it's something that you want to avoid at all costs. But unfortunately, many places are going that way. And that is why families become more and more and more important. A father and a mother who know where their children are, who make sure their children are at school for 8 hours a day, who make sure they are role models for their children and take their education seriously. That can't prevent kids going on drugs. Obviously, some very, very committed and loving parents have kids that go on drugs. And it happens for a whole range of reasons. But there we have to have social cohesion, families taking responsibility, the state taking responsibility. We've got the best metro police force in the world under J.P. Smith. It's the best, I'm not in the world, in South Africa, I don't know in other countries, but the best in South Africa by far under J.P. Smith. If it wasn't for him, it would be much, much worse, much, much worse than it is now. He has done the most amazing job in establishing law and order in some very, very lawless places.
Mm. But that is not experienced by everyone.
It's experienced by a lot of people. Mm. And they, you know, the people who do experience it haven't got a control group. They don't know if JP wasn't there with his Metro Police, what it would be like. Mm. Mm. And the community has a critical role in reducing crime. Mm. They know who's stealing those cables. They
but
know.
So do the authorities.
No.
Like I take it.
We have to get evidence.
No, in terms of making sure that there are prosecutions, that they're.
We've got to get evidence.
The police station works.
Yeah. Well, it's not the local government's job to get the police station to work. Police is a national competency, Mike. That is why Becky Kele got all the flak from us. We've just got a metro police that has got a very limited remit under the Constitution. Getting police stations to work is now a minister, Nkunu's job. That's his job now. He's got to do that. He's got to get that happening. We would like to play. And that is where you need meritocratic appointments in the police service. You've got to get crack detectives. You've got to get absolutely excellent, the gatherers of evidence. You've got to get really crack policemen if you want to have convictions. And you have to have a really advanced witness protection program. Because you saw people are getting assassinated all over the place because they're investigating fraudsters and other things like that.
But over and above the question of social cohesion, which I don't think anyone will argue with you about, you would agree that the authorities have the responsibility to better the infrastructure.
Of course.
In many of the places.
Of course. And in Cape Town, we're spending more on infrastructure development for all communities, especially the poor, more on infrastructure than all the other metros put together. That's what we're doing because we don't steal the money. Okay. And we invest that money properly and we don't have cadres skimming off the tenders and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Can I, you know, before we transition, you know, to some of the other stuff that I wanted us to talk about, what would it, the GNU, what would happen if it could it collapse?
Yes,
and,
of course.
And it could if collapse. It were to collapse, what would happen in your view?
Of course, it could collapse. If it collapses, it'll be very unfortunate. Either Cyril Ramaphosa will have to run a minority government, or we'll have to do a coalition with someone else.
The DA and other...
Well, I mean, if it collapses, then... Look, the only party that's essential to the GNU is the DA and the ANC.
Mm-hmm.
The other parties aren't essential. They've got no leverage in the GNU. They can't bring the government down.
Mm-hmm.
They are there by grace and favor of Cyril Ramaphosa. If they irritate Cyril Ramaphosa, they're out. And they've got no leverage whatsoever.
Mm.
But we have leverage because if we go out, then the government falls.
Mm.
But you don't play that card lightly because you can only play that card once.
Mm. Let's move on now to other stuff. Once upon a time, that's why you know all the secrets of how newsrooms work and how editing works. You were a journalist once. You know, I remember you know, the first time I noticed you was when you were covering the Steve Biko inquest, which you did very well, I must say, you know, all those many years ago. But then you moved from journalism to politics. What caused the turn?
What caused the turn was my editor was fired, Alistair Sparks, and I was cross about that. I was really cross. And then I worked as the DA's, I mean, the Rand Daily Mail's political correspondent for a while, but I didn't get on with the new editor. And we clashed quite badly at one particular point. And then I just resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to university for a while and did a few courses, which I enjoyed as an occasional student. And then I started freelancing for overseas newspapers. And then I went into politics by accident.
Mm. Why? Did you feel that journalism wasn't doing for you what politics could do? Or?
No. No, not that. I didn't want to go back. When I was somebody approached me about possibly being the editor of the Cape Times, but that didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so I was very active in my children's primary school. I was on the board of governors and I was the chair of the governing body. And then the government started this voluntary severance package and redeployment scheme, which I was very opposed to. And I got 80 schools together. We mobilized 80 schools and we took the government to court and we won. Mm. And at the time I was writing a lot about education policy in the newspapers. And Tony Leon phoned me and said, would I look at the DP at the time? Would I look at their education policy and tell him what I think of it? And I said, this isn't a good policy. It's not a good policy at all. I'll rewrite the policy for you if you would like me to. So I did. And that was adopted by the party. And then Tony Leon asked me and said, would you like to put your hat in the ring to become an MPL in the province? Because we think we might have the balance of power. And if you get in, we have a very competitive process in the DP and now the DA. If you get in, you might end up implementing your own policy. So I thought to myself, I was working at UCT at that stage. And I thought to myself, that's not a bad idea. Let me put my hat in the ring. I didn't know that I'd get chosen or that I'd get into an electable position. So I put my hat into the ring and I was the last person who got elected on the list for the DP then in the provincial legislature. And then we did the coalition and then I became the MEC for education. So, you know.
How would you describe yourself, Helen?
Myself?
Because, you know, a lot of people know your political dimension.
No, they don't.
In other words,
they have no idea about my political dimension.
They see you as Helen the politician. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And it looks like you never shy away from a good fight.
Oh, well, on a principle, politics. I'll never shy away from a fight never.
Now, is there a difference between the political persona versus the private Helen? When Helen is at home, with her family or friends?
Look, I'm always...
It's formidable at home, as you are in politics.
I grew up in a family where my parents stood very firm on principles and would defend any principle, however unpopular. And my parents were very strongly anti-apartheid, and I remember having a lot of arguments with their friends around it, and they did not back down. And I admired them for that. I thought it was a good thing to do. And I learned from them to stand up for what you believe in and to stand up for your principles. It's also critically important to learn how to pick your battles. And I'm not very good at that. Well, I wasn't very good at that, but I've become much better. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson said, on matters of style, flow with the current. On matters of principle, stand like a rock. And you've got to work out which are the matters of principle, and then you stand like a rock. And many people don't actually often understand or see the principle behind the position that you're taking. They just see the position. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy doing it often. Look, I've been married for 42 years very happily. A lot of people, you know, I remember somebody once introduced me at a big public event. He said, this is Helen Ziller, and all I can say is that I'm glad I'm not married to her. Now, you know, I hope my husband is glad that he's married to me. We've stuck it out for 42 years. We've got two wonderful children. They've got the one's got a wife, the other's got a lovely partner. And the one with a wonderful wife has got two beautiful children. So we're a very, very tight family. And we do everything we can to support each other. And, you know, my colleagues, I usually make friends with the people that I work with, and very rarely have the people that I've worked with closely turned against me. Mm. They've been very, very loyal to me. So I've got good relationships there. They know, again, what you see is what you get. I'm very direct. And, yeah, you know, they call me Gorgs at work, Gorgo. Mm-hmm. So that's shortened to Gorgs. So everyone calls me Gorgs. Mm-hmm. And I quite like it now. It's become a general name for me, Gorgs, when they see me.
You like Gorgs? Gorgs. But do you like Godzilla and Gorgozil and all of
that? Yeah, Godzilla. The first person who made that word was my son, my eldest son, because I used to make him do his homework, and I used to make him do this, and I make him do this, and I used to get cross if he didn't. And he used to call me Godzilla, you know, because I was the strict one in the family. My husband was the gentle one. So they my boys nicknamed me Godzilla, mm-hmm. very lovingly, you know. It wasn't an insult, very lovingly. Mm-hmm. And so then that name stuck, and that name got out there, Godzilla. So I don't mind that. I mean, I don't mind any of the nicknames, you know. That's mm-hmm. what it is.
Mm-hmm. Comes with the territory.
Comes with the territory.
Yeah, yeah. How would you describe your politics, Helen? What are you? Are you a liberal? Are you a
I'm a
social
liberal.
Democrat?
I hate being pigeonholed, but I'm a classical liberal. I'm not a liberal like they defined it in the United States. Mm-hmm. Liberals in the United States are not liberal at all. So I'm liberal. I'm non-racial. I really don't believe that a person's race is the most important thing about them at all. I believe that a person's character, a person's conduct, a person's integrity, a person's ethics is much more important than their color. So I'm genuinely non-racial, and I've been raised to be that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, from my first day, I was raised to be that way. And I've raised my children that way too. I'm non-racial. I am a social democrat economically, but I believe that you need a market system to grow an economy. And without growth, you don't have the tax base to support the poor. So I don't believe it is a thing that South Africa should boast about that a third of the population is on social welfare grants. They should all be working. They should all be in productive jobs and paying taxes so that the people who really can't look after themselves get decent support from the state, right? So I believe in market economies to get growth and to get jobs, most critically. I believe that we can get our society to work, but then we've got to understand that the cultural values of our constitution are sacrosanct and that we have to abide by the rule of law. I'm very much in favor of the rule of law and not the rule of individuals. Mm. And so that's who I am.
Mm. How do you relax? Because I'm sure as a federal chair, you're on the road a lot. Starting fires.
Being on the road is not tiring, Mike. Mm. I mean, you know, on an airplane, what can you do? People who say to me they get tired traveling around, I say, I just sit on an airplane. What do you do? I mean, I often work and I do other things, but it's not tiring. Mm. If you have a small bag and you don't have to schlep big things, it's not tiring to sit on an airplane. Mm. No, I mean, I've never been less tired than I am now. Okay. I've never had more sleep than I get now, never in my life that I can remember. And now I have chances to do hobbies because I have grandchildren, Mike. Mm. And my biggest joy in life is to be with them. And to have fun times with them and to think of fun things to do with them and to read books with them and to play games with them. We laugh ourselves silly and I write stories with my granddaughter and we do all kinds of things. Mm. So that's my best thing because I couldn't often do that with my children. That's my one regret. That's my one regret that I didn't spend enough time with my children. Fortunately, they turned
out. Because of the politics?
Because of my work. Mm. I was working day and night. I mean, you know, I had really big jobs. I was the mayor of Cape Town leading a 7-party coalition, and I was the leader of the DA nationally at the same time. Those are two big jobs. And my children were young at the time and facing all the challenges of youth and all of that sort of thing. It was really not easy, you know. Now it's a walk in the park in comparison.
Mm. And now, we're about to depart. Mm-hmm. Do you see a point where Helen Ziller retires from politics? And what would she do if she left politics?
Look, I mean, I'm so glad my children stayed in this country. I'm so glad my grandchildren are here. Every motivation of mine is to make this country safe for everybody's children and for everybody's grandchildren. I want every single child to have a real opportunity in this country. And that's what I've had been motivated by my whole life. To get South Africa to work. My parents were refugees. They came to South Africa as refugees. And I just wanted to make the place that gave them a home a successful country. And I will carry on doing that till I die. I might not be actively involved in politics, but I will carry on in one way or the other. I mean, my husband now, he's retired, he's 81. He teaches at Makwane Primary School in Langa on a Thursday morning. He teaches their maths there. And that's the kind of thing I will do till they carry me out in a box.
Helen Ziller, thank you very much for a very interesting conversation.
Thanks very much.
And for being open with us, you know, and sharing your views on the various subjects that we've talked about.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.